I failed to mention something about Youngstown this morning. You know, they all had to get up early and be there by 11 o'clock, and we do a reverse service. I give the sermon at the beginning, and then I take off, and I gave the announcements, too. They took about as long as here, just real short announcements, but then I give the sermon, then Jimmy Guy comes back and leads another song, and then I think Steve Nozzle was up for the sermonette today. And then they end the service. But in order to get back here in time for that, it was the only way we can do it. But I was happy to report that we had a full house at Youngstown, in spite of the fact that three of the guys are down with a flu bug, and one other member was unable to be there. We had several new prospective members that were are begun attending, and otherwise everybody was able to be there, including Dan Stewart. First time he's been back to services after the fall. Up there at that, it was an electric power plant up on in Ashtabula, right on the lake, where it was the building they were dismantling and when he fell. But not using a walker anymore. He hasn't been using a walker for 2 weeks. The therapist cleared him to use a cane. So walker gets tossed and he grabs a cane right away, and he's recovering very, very remarkably well from the amount of injuries that he sustained. So that's all good, and I just bring you the greetings from the brethren up there. It was a very energetic, cheerful bunch this morning. And they heard the same sermon. I'm going to do a little switch up in the way that I deliver it. I'd hardly ever start a sermon with a joke. But this one, I'm going to make an exception. Maybe that'll become evident as we go. But in my announcements in the commentary, you know, I mentioned something about being at Ambassador College, and that brought back a flood of memories. I attended the Bricket Wood campus. We had three campuses of Ambassador College, one in Pasadena, California. That was the church headquarters in those days, as most of you remember. The other was in Big Sandy, Texas, which is about... And then the smallest campus was the international campus. It was Bricket Wood, England. Technically, we were in the county of Hertfordshire. But most people don't care about that. As long as you're in one shire or another over there, you're fine. We were in Hertfordshire. It was about an hour north of London. And by walking 10 minutes off campus, we were in sort of in the countryside, and we had a research farm and surrounded by other farm grounds. So it was a very beautiful setting. But you walk about 10 or 12 minutes to get to the local train station, and then it would run you down to the city of Watford. It had a big train station, and then you could be anywhere in London, any main train station, within an hour of leaving the dorm. If you planned your schedule according to the train schedule, you would be. But we had a lot of fun there. It was an interesting campus. About a third of us, it was the smallest campus, as I said. We had about 250 students, and a third of them were Americans. A third of them were British, either Britain, Ireland, North Ireland, Scotland, Wales, the rest of the other third, we included Canadians and New Zealanders and Australians. Actually, there were quite a few Australians, South Africans, and a few from various parts of Europe and other parts of the world. So we had a nice international mix, which was a lot of fun. And we had a grand sense of humor. I can't speak for the other campuses, but I know that we had fun. You know, there's a bantering sort of teasing humor that is the British humor. You don't necessarily think about that until you get to talking with them. The Australians thrive on sarcasm too, but it was a gentle sarcasm. You know, I tease you because I like you. Essentially, is what it was. Americans don't understand that. Now, just there are a few Americans, you know, and I think several of you here are real naturals at that. You'd have fit right in. But not everybody does. So about 2 weeks before the next freshman class would arrive, this would be in late summer, they get us all together in assembly, and they say, all right, the students will be arriving soon, the new students, and many, of course, a third of which would be from the States. They say, we want you to cut back on the sarcasm, or you'll make the American girls cry. As it turned out, there were a couple of boys that would cry too. But so, you know, it was how we teased and bantered with each other. But We cut it back until they got acclimatized to it, and then once they acclimatized to it, they joined right in and had a lot of fun. So sometimes in that kind of tone of humor, we would tell Irish jokes because we were in England. Even the Irish would tell Irish jokes, but they also had their English jokes. Usually they were the same jokes, you just switched the people's names. So here's the Irish joke that went around campus, and we thought it was so funny that we always remembered it with a hand signal. It was a young Irishman named Paddy. He worked on a farm with his father, and he decided he'd take a holiday. That's a vacation in the British Isles. And he would go to London Town. And his father said, "Well, you go to London Town, you be careful with the English, Paddy." And he says, "Oh, I will, Father." So off he went. He got to London. He went into a pub, usual thing in England. A pub is not like a tavern or a bar here in America. Maybe they are more now, but back in the 70s, it wasn't like that. They were country pubs had always had a backyard with swing sets and a merry-go-round usually, because families in the community would come down, mom and dad would come down, and they would sit down and have a pint of beer in the back table out in the yard there. The children are playing on their playground equipment and drinking their lemonades. And it was a much more congenial setting than most of the drinking houses in this country. Totally different. So Patrick, though, ended up in one of the city ones, and he came into the pub and he got his pint and he was having a sip, and there was an Englishman standing next to him. He said, "You're Irish, aren't you?" He says, "Yes, I'm Irish." And he says, "Did you know that you're thick?" And Patty said he didn't know what he meant by thick. He says, but he was sure he wasn't. He says, "No, I'm not thick." He says, "Yes, you are." "No, I'm not." "Yes, you are." "I'll prove it to you. I'm not thick." And the Englishman said, "Okay, follow me." So they walked over, and the pub's over there. It was kind of intimidating for an American to go to be in England at that stage in life, because so many buildings were older than your country. We had a barn on the campus. We stacked hay in this barn, and in the 1970s, it was 400 years old. And that was a lot older than America was then. So it was this, and these buildings, to stand like that, typically had oak timbers. English oak is very strong oak. And so they walked over to one of the oak timbers that held up the pub, and the Englishman stuck his hand in front of the timber. He said, "Hit my hand." And he says, "I don't want to do that. I heard it." Now he said, "No, hit it." So Patty's a big, strong guy. He gets his fist and he swings as hard as he can, and the Englishman drops his hand. Crunch. He said, "See, I told you, you're thick." "I'm not thick." I said, "Yes, you are." He says, "Let me try again." Sticks his other hand up. Same thing. So Patty decided he'd learned something, and he went back home from his holiday, and he got off the train station, like everywhere, and he had to walk someplace to get home. And so he's walking past the fields of their farm, and there's his father out there plowing. So he's excited. He wants to tell him what he learned. He hops over the fence and trots out. "Father, father," he says, "I learned something in England." He said, "What did you learn, Patty?" He said, "I learned that I'm thick." And he says, "What do you mean you're thick, Patty?" And Patty's, both hands are in bandages, but he looks around for a post or something upright, and there isn't anything in the middle of the field. So he says, "Hit me hand, Dad." Ever after that, when that joke made its circulation in a college community there, if somebody wasn't getting it, wasn't understanding a joke or understanding a point that you're trying to explain to them, somebody in the crowd would pretty soon have their hand up like this as a signal. And then you'd realize, "Oh, okay, let me try again." We had lots of fun with that, and lots of fun with many other humorous and enjoyable things. It was harmless humor. The Irish would tell the same joke about the English. So they just traded them back and forth like that. But let me ask you this question. Did you ever think that Jesus of Nazareth was funny? You think Christ could tell a joke? Now that's one that is a concept that for many is hard to wrap around a mind around. All of Christianity, the world's version and the true version of God's church, at least claim to look to Christ as their example of right thinking and right behavior in all aspects of life. Except perhaps in humor. And I think the reason why that is never talked about much, I mean, literally, it's never talked about much. I have a collection of the books that have written about Christ's sense of humor, and it's like 3 books long. And they aren't very thick ones. Hardly anybody thinks about that. In fact, most think that he wasn't funny at all. I have one of those little books I have called, it's literally titled The Humor of Christ, the same title as the sermon. And it's written by a man named Elton Trueblood back in the 1960s. He perceived some things, and it was really eye-opening to read his little booklet and compare the scriptures that he was citing. So here's a comment from his book. The fact that we have often developed a false pattern of Christ's character, or the fact is we have often developed a false pattern for Christ's character. Though we do not always say so directly, we habitually think of him as mild in manner, endlessly patient, grave in speech, and serious, almost to the point of dourness. Well, that probably is, to a certain degree, at least, calculates how we view the possibility that Jesus Christ had a sense of humor and exhibited it during his human ministry. Now, this is a two-part subject, so sometime I'll give the second part. You know, the humor of God, as in God the Father and Christ in the Old Testament, but we're going to look at the humor of Christ, focusing primarily on the New Testament, and I hope that when we're done, you'll have a better appreciation for it. I did have to explain the jokes to the folks in Youngstown. They didn't get them. And so we'll see how it works for you. But let's look at some of the evidence of Christ's sense of humor. I think when you figure this out and when you start to think it through, it's going to add a wonderful aspect to his character and a greater appreciation, frankly, for his Passover sacrifice when you do that. Let's go to Galatians chapter 5. Now, as you're going to Galatians chapter 5, ask yourself, what's in Galatians 5? I know that's a memory scripture, or part of it is. What is in chapter 5 of Galatians? There are two things that we consistently turn to that chapter for. One are the works of the flesh, the typical sins of humanity. That starts in verse 19, goes through verse 21. The other thing, and we're not going to focus on those today specifically, the other thing that we find in Galatians 5 are the fruits of the Spirit, or the fruits of God's Holy Spirit working in our lives. So let's read those, and then let's think about this just for a minute. It's in verse 22. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. There's no law against any of those things. It's all good. It's all good, as we say these days. Well, let's go back to the beginning. Why are they in that order? Remember over in 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter, where it says there are these three, faith, hope, and charity, or faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. So love is prioritized above even faith and hope. Therefore, we could reason that love is the greatest, you know, fruit of the Spirit. God is love. It's one of the scriptures. He epitomizes it. And outgoing concern for others is expressed in the two great commandments. You shall love the Lord your God with all your mind and heart and, you know, your very being. And you love your neighbor as yourself. So now we go back and look at the fruits of the Spirit, and the primary one is listed first. Thus, it's possible that they're in a descending order. Not that it makes a great deal of difference, because we want to exhibit all of these things. But it is joy that comes after love. In fact, that is noted so often that back when surnames were invented, or I don't know if they were invented, but they were required back in the... It was the late Middle Ages, actually, 12 to 1300s in Europe. And sometimes you had to purchase a good surname in some countries. The better the name, especially if you're Jewish, the higher the price. Hence, people who have names like Goldstein, well, they played a lot of Goldstein for that. You betcha. But, you know, Dirty Shoe, wait, I don't know if anybody was named Dirty Shoe, but that one would come cheaper. But I'll bet you what, that in England, Lovejoy, which is a fairly common last name in England, Lovejoy probably came at a top price. That'd be a great name. Two of the first two fruits of the Spirit. But the fact is, joy is one of the fruits of the Spirit. And when we laugh, what are we expressing? We're expressing some form of joy. If the laughter is not derisive, disrespectful, you know, irritating, sinful laughter, of course, we're not talking about that. We're talking about the kind of humor Christ would exhibit. Now, then using that, we have one piece of evidence that the fruit of the Spirit of joy is very high ranking. It is one, number one, it is a fruit of the Spirit, and it's the second one. And then number two, have you ever studied how stories go together? You know, plot lines, you probably did that back in school. And we've managed to forget it as much as we can over the years, all the things that we did. But some of those were beneficial, and they stuck with us because we remember them. You know, you know what a tragedy is. The Greek tragedies, for example. You had to study Greek tragedies. Some of the most famous stories in Western education are Greek tragedies. There's one thing that I always liked about Greek tragedies is there was a certain measure of predictability to the story. Everybody died. That's how they all ended. Everybody died. That's a Greek tragedy. Now, so we'll digress and go north from Greece. Greek Orthodox Church split from the Roman Church, and it was at the 500s AD, and then eventually helped to give rise to what was the Russian Orthodox Church. So we're going to go up to Russia. And in fact, Russia was so heavily influenced by the Greek Orthodox that the Russian language is written in Greek letters, even today, for the most part. So we have the Greek tragedy moves forward to become essentially the Russian tragedy. And the Russian people, especially during the communist era, this is where this story comes out of. They were well acquainted with tragedy, you know. It was spelled with the KGB and Siberia and the salt mines and tragedy upon tragedy. And so the Russian stories, and this is how they dealt with the communist overlords, is that they had an acerbic sense of humor that in a Russian tragedy, just like a Greek tragedy, everybody dies. In fact, in a Russian comedy, everybody dies. They just die happy. Now, how are you going to cope with a communist government like the Soviet Union was plagued with for 70 years unless you find something to laugh at? And that was part of how they did it. A Russian comedy. Everybody dies, they just die happy. Well, now let's look at the Bible. What is the plot line of the Bible? You know, it's a collection of all those books stuck together, New Testament, Old Testament, but it's all one unit. It starts on a high point, God. The eternal existence of God. You know, in a tragedy, you start at a high point and you go down to and you end at a low point. Somebody dies or everybody dies. Well, the low point in the Bible has to be the death of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. But then we know, but it didn't end there. Exactly. Christ was resurrected, and then came the prophecies of, you know, that doorway being open so that humans, when they repent and follow God, ultimately can go through the same door and have eternal life. So in that sense, the plot line of the Bible starts at a high point, comes down to a low point, and ends on a high point. You know what that's called? A comedy. A comedy always ends, except for Russian comedies, it always ends on a high point. Now, maybe they thought that was a high point back in the communist era, if everybody dies. I mean, mostly we don't think of the Bible as a comedy, but technically, from the plot line of the story flow of the Bible, it is. That's just how, you know, it would be viewed from a literary standpoint. But why do we miss the humor of Christ? There has to be some. If joy is such a high ranking fruit of God's Spirit, then there has to be a sense of humor that Christ himself would have exhibited. Elton Trueblood again, same book I quoted from earlier. The widespread failure to recognize and appreciate the humor of Christ is one of the most amazing aspects of the era named for him. Anyone who reads the Synoptic Gospels, synoptic means seen together, or together seen, sin from synthesis, meaning together, and then optic for the optic nerve, seen together. That would be Matthew, Mark, and Luke. You always view them together because they have parallel accounts. So those are the Synoptic Gospels, those three. Anyone who reads the Synoptic Gospels with relative freedom from presuppositions might be expected to see that Christ laughed and that he expected others to laugh. But our capacity to miss this aspect of his life is quite phenomenal. We are so sure that he was always so deadly serious that we often twist his words in order to try to make them conform to our preconceived mold. A misguided piety has made us fear that acceptance of his wit and humor would somehow be mildly blasphemous or sacrilegious. Religion, we think, is serious business, and serious business is incompatible with banter. That's the reason why we have missed the humor of Christ. And yet, it is a fascinating and marvelous study. Let's go to some examples of Christ's humor. Let's start with the main technique that he used. And if you study humor, most people don't. We just laugh if it seems funny. But there is a study of how it's put together. Comedians are mostly well-versed in that, because that's what they do. Irony is one of the classic styles of humor. It has this unexpected ending. Everything's going along, and then suddenly something out of the ordinary, or what, other than what you expect, happens, and it's ironic. So irony expresses itself in various ways. For example, even a wordplay is an irony. It's a pun, too. To use a word that has two meanings, and you, it sounds like you're using one meaning, but you really mean the other meaning, and the fact that it's unexpected to use that word, and that sentence is where the funny comes in. So there are various ways that we can find that. We're going to just look at the classic, four examples of classic aspects of Christ's humor, and now try to think about this and analyze what went on. I think the first one will make the point clear enough. It's chapter 2 of John. Most of us know chapter 2 of John is when Christ turned the water into wine. And we say, yeah, so what's funny about that? Put Moog and David out of business. Hold it. They've been out of business for a long time, I think. Well, that's actually the funny. Is turning the water into wine. You gotta think outside the usual box of laughter that, you know, is your repertoire of laughter, and analyze this. On the third day, there was a wedding. Now, Christ has, to give you the background, he has already called his early disciples. Some of them took a period of weeks or maybe a few months before he had all the 12 disciples, and then, of course, he had 70 more that were in addition to the 12 ones that would be the apostles. We'll touch bases on with them in a minute, but some of the 12 are with him at this time. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. Now, that doesn't mean Canaan, like the land of Canaan, which was another term for the land of Israel prior to the Israelites coming. This is actually a village up in the north of Israel in the valley around the Sea of Galilee. That's where Cana is. So it wouldn't have been terribly far from where Jesus grew up in Nazareth, which is about 8 miles from north of the, or not north, but 8 miles uphill, and largely a little north, but mostly west of the Sea of Galilee. It wouldn't be terribly far from there. So the wedding's in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. So Mary was at the wedding. Now you're going to find out she wasn't just there attending, she was there helping with the wedding. Pay close attention to what we usually read over and miss. Now, both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. Okay, so we got everybody there. And when they ran out of wine, well, why would they run out of wine at a wedding? Well, they had weddings were larger affairs than they typically are, I suppose, in our day. Especially for those who could afford them, they would have a wedding feast that might last multiple days, 3-4 days or so. And then you're feeding an awful lot of guests, and you could run out of wine. Well, it happened. They ran out of wine. When they ran out of wine, get the rest of the sentence, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. But she didn't say it like that. Understand that Mary was a Jewish mother. There is a Jewish culture. We should be familiar with it. There are many Jewish folks that live in the greater Cleveland, Akron area. And they are, actually, most of our comedians are Jewish. Did you know that? We have hardly any that aren't Jewish. And those who aren't Jewish typically use a Jewish approach to humor. Even some of the great African-American humorists, and there's some really funny ones, and some of them, of course, that tell kind of jokes we don't want to listen to, but the ones that were good used the Jewish style delivery because they defined what an onstage comedian or comedian would be going clear back to the 1920s when they were immigrating into America and trying to find work. Irony is their funny line, or their tactic of humor. So she says they have no wine. So let me tell you, this is a joke about a Jewish grandmother who went on vacation with her son, who was a doctor, and his wife and their children, and they stayed at a hotel that had a big swimming pool in a courtyard. And one day at the hotel, she's visiting with her daughter-in-law and the grandkids, and her son comes walking in. He went over to get a soda, and he's walking back. He slips on the edge of the pool, and he falls and cracks his head and falls in the pool. And she panics, and she runs into the lobby of the hotel shouting, "My son, the doctor, he's drowning." All right, 2, 3, now 4. Yeah. She had to tell everybody he's a doctor before she tells them he's drowning. You see, that was the funny part. She's proud of the fact that her son is a doctor. And she wants the whole world to know it, even though he's drowning. They're going to know he's a doctor. Now we need help. So now bring that back. We're talking about a Jewish mother who has to be very, very proud of the ultimate son that any woman could have, Jesus Christ. And so when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." It's not that, "What do you know? They have no wine." No, it's, "They have no wine. Do something about it," is what she's saying. And Jesus said to her, he knew exactly what she was doing, but we read right over it. We miss the whole drama that's unfolding here, the entire humorousness of it. And he said to her, "Woman," and we think, why would he call his mother woman? Because it was a respectful term of addressing a female of the species, woman. It's not so much today, maybe, but it was then. "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My time has not yet come," or "my hour has not yet come." And you think, oh yeah, his hour hadn't come. You know, he's just starting his ministry. Yeah, right. Like she didn't know that? Mary was present, you remember, for his birth and the conception and the visit by Gabriel the angel to explain what was going to happen. She knew all that. She was a key player in the life of Jesus Christ. And God inspired her with a prophecy about him that she got to actually give. And she visited her cousin Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, and the exchange that took place with them. And then when they dedicated Jesus, took him to the temple to make the offering of the 2 turtle doves having been blessed with a baby, there was an ancient prophet, Simeon, and a prophetess whose name was Anna. And she was right there holding the baby while they pronounced their blessings, which were also prophecies about Christ. Yeah, Mary knew exactly who she was talking to, and she knew exactly that he could do something about the fact that they have no wine. And so he said, he knows that she knows that, and obviously, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come, mother. And his mother said to the servant, she had nothing more to him. She turned to the servants and said, do whatever he says. You know, that, okay, are you getting a feeling that maybe something similar has happened before? I do. You know, maybe not in a public way, but in a private time where it provided for someone. And there were 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of the purification of the Jews. And they'd have the water on hand so they could go through, wash their hands up to their elbows. And then this was the storage units for the water. And each contained 20 or 30 gallons. So we're talking somewhere between 120 to 180 total gallons of water that these would hold. And Jesus said to them, he didn't argue with her anymore. Notice that. He turned to the servants and he said, fill the water pots with water. Well, that took them a little while, but they filled them to the brim. And then they all lined up just in front of him. We got it done. And then he said to them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. The master of the feast is not the groom. The master of the feast is the man that's coordinating the feast for the groom and the bride. So they brought the wine to the master of the feast, and he tasted the water that had been made wine and did not know where it came from. But the servants knew where it came from. And the master of the feast called the bridegroom, and he said to him, every man at the beginning sets out the good wine when everybody's taste buds are able to pick it up. But after the guests have all well drunk, they've had, you know, wine and food and everything, then they bring out the less good wine, the inferior wine. But you kept the good wine to the last. You know, this is remarkable. So what happened was, by the way, you have to stop and think about it. He turned up, made 120 to 180 gallons of the finest wine, and maybe, we don't know this for sure, but it's one of those Bible study questions, first time in the millennium, once we get through the big ones, we can ask, was that, in fact, the all-time best wine the world has ever seen? I think it's a good chance that it was. You stop to think about it. But it's this humorous interaction between Christ and Mary, and then some of the disciples and the servants are all privy. They're the audience and that are participating in this humorous rejoinder going back and forth between them. This is a classic example of Christ's sense of humor. This is why joy ranks so high in the fruits of the Spirit. Just for the joy of doing it and providing a superb wine for this great big feast of people that would be able to savor it and enjoy it. Now, that's a marvelous one. Let's go to another one, just the next page over. Now, this one is a little bit of a jump. It's in chapter 3. And it's about Nicodemus. And we know Nicodemus. He's a Pharisee. We know that because it says it right there. We know that the Pharisees were very literal-minded, and they didn't get jokes. And if you were talking Pharisee in humor in the same sentence, other Jewish hands would come up immediately like this. You said Pharisee, didn't you? They don't get jokes. In fact, don't try to joke with them. They don't laugh. So there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews, meaning he was in the Sanhedrin, which was the governing council of the Jews that operated and governed the Jewish people underneath the Roman umbrella. This man came to Jesus by night and said to him, Rabbi, or teacher, we know that you are a teacher, come from God. For no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. Now, Nicodemus believed Christ. He didn't understand him fully yet, but he did believe in him, and he ended up in the church. And you'll find that his name pops up later in the New Testament. So he was on his way in. But he comes, you know, we know that you are a teacher from God, otherwise you couldn't do these things. And Jesus didn't say, thank you. Well, I'm glad you understand that, Nicodemus. He didn't say that. In fact, he didn't say anything that seemed to have anything to do with the conversation up to that point. He throws a total curveball straight back to Nicodemus. He says, "Most assuredly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." Look what Nicodemus said. Now look what Christ said. Why did he say that? He was baiting his friend. In one sense, he was baiting. He was also going to teach him a very important lesson. So Nicodemus, it catches him off guard, and he reverts back to his literal Pharisaical thinking, and he said to him, "How can a man be born when he's old? Can he enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born?" He's trying to reason it out from the physical perspective. You know, we do that sometimes. We're like Nicodemus. And he missed the fact that Christ was, frankly, was toying with him. He was preparing him to teach a lesson. You see, humor is used as a teaching tool. And it breaks you out of the mold where you're open to listening, and then you get a fresh approach to whatever task it is that you're up against, in as far as comprehension goes, and then you can see it from a new perspective, and then you understand it. But Jesus didn't respond to Nicodemus's overture. He threw a challenge to him in a humorous way. It was a serious challenge, but it was humorous because it threw Nicodemus exactly off guard, like Christ anticipated that he would go. And yet it opened up Nicodemus to learn some things. And Christ goes on with the teaching session. So he uses a teaching tool there. Let's go to Luke 24. Oh, this is a good one. You'll love this one. In fact, Christ had told this joke in Egypt, they'd had him rolling in the Nile. Never mind. Luke 24, we'll start in verse 13. Now this is after Christ's resurrection, because this chapter covers the resurrection of Christ. It covers the Sunday morning. Saturday night, Christ was resurrected. At the end of the Sabbath, the ladies come to do the embalming and everything on the next morning when it's light. They can't do it in the dark. And the tomb's been empty. Been empty for hours, actually. So verse 13 is a little bit later in the day. And there were two of them, of the disciples, were that same day traveling to a village called Emmaus. So this is usually, the story is usually referred to as the road to Emmaus. Not Emmaus, but Emmaus. Which was 7 miles from Jerusalem. And in verse 14, they talked together of all these things that had happened. And obviously they believed Christ was the Messiah. They were deeply concerned. This was what their life was about now. But their mourning, they didn't expect the Messiah to die. They expected that he'd gather all the Romans and drop kick them into the Mediterranean Sea. I mean, they call it Mare Nostrum, our sea. So why doesn't he just toss them there? Let us have our freedom. That was the whole idea of having a Messiah in the minds of most of the Jewish people. So they weren't comprehending what actually had happened, and they were trying to sort it out. And then verse 14, they talked together, those things that had happened. And in verse 15, so it was as they conversed and they reasoned that Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were restrained. Remember that, restrained. Their eyes were restrained so that they did not know him or recognize him. And he said to them, you know, or either that or he had his, you know, using his Jedi hood kind of pulled down where his face is in the shadow of the hood. One or the other. Except it was this way. In verse 17, he says, "What kind of conversation is this that you have with one another as you walk and are sad? What's happening, fellows?" And then one whose name was Cleopas said to him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem? And have you not known the things that happened there in these days?" And Jesus said, "What things?" Now, this is called the Socratic method. Socrates didn't invent it. It's feigning ignorance so that you can learn more. And they said to him, "The things concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. Indeed, besides all this, today is the third day since these things happened, and yes, certain women of our company who arrived at the tomb early astonished us when they did not find his body. And they came saying that they have also seen a vision of angels who said he was alive, and a certain of those who were with us went to the tomb," and Peter and John specifically, "and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see." And then in verse 25, Christ said to them, "O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe in all the things the prophets have spoken, ought not the Christ, the Messiah, to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory? Isn't this what God planned?" And then beginning at Moses in the Pentateuch and through all the prophets, he expounded to them all the scriptures, in all the scriptures, the things concerning himself. Now, you're starting at the beginning of the Bible and going through the entire Old Testament, going through all those scriptures. They were walking probably not super fast on their way to Emmaus, and it was 7 miles, and they got one of the finest dissertations on the fulfillment of messianic prophecy that you could ask for. So finally, verse 28, they drew near the village where they were going, and he indicated that he would have gone further. But they constrained him, saying, "Abide with us, stay here with us tonight at the inn. And because it's toward evening and the day is far spent." So he went in to stay with them. And it came to pass, as he sat at the table with them, he took bread and he blessed it, and then he broke it. In those days, they didn't have knives for slicing bread like we do in America, where we slice it into a nice, even little slices so we can make sandwiches out of it. Paying homage to the great Englishman, the Earl of Sandwich, who invented sandwiches in 1684, I think it was. It was the Earl of Sandwich. Those days, they just took a hunk of bread and tore it apart and gave pieces to people. And that's how they ate it. And they didn't eat sandwiches because things fell out from between those uneven slices of bread, or pieces of bread. But Christ handed them each a piece of bread, and then their eyes were opened and they knew him. They recognized who he was and who had been talking to them all this time, and then poof, he vanishes. And he hands them the bread, they recognize him, get the shocked look on their face and unable to get a sound out, and then he just disappears. And you think, yeah, so where's the punchline? All right, one, he just disappears. Poof. After all that, he just disappears. And two, they didn't recognize him the whole time. That's the joke. It's not a joke in the sense of just for the sake of a joke. It's the humor of it all that was injected into a most serious setting to help them, frankly, help them cope with the sadness. But they didn't recognize him. Remember, go back there. It said that their eyes were restrained in verse 16. Who restrained their eyes? In other words, who blocked them from recognizing who they were talking to? Christ himself. He had that power. Now, if he has the power to go poof and disappear, he has the power to block their eyes from recognizing him. So they're talking to him and they don't even realize who they're talking with. Well, I thought it was funny. Maybe if you think about it a while, you'll sort of capture the sheer joy of being able to do that and helping the disciples to have a certain lightheartedness about life. Serious all the same, but lightheartedness. Now, I'm sure you'll get this next one, though. Let's go to Matthew chapter 14. This is one of my favorites. Finishes feeding the 5,000. Well, we think it's 5,000. It's 5,000 men in verse 21, besides women and children. Now, we're talking like maybe he fed 12 or 15,000 people miraculously, which is almost a funny thing to comprehend. Massive and funny that he could just do that, but he did. because he has that power. And immediately, in verse 22, by this time the disciples are entirely worn out from in the press of the crowd, and he had been teaching them, and so he made his disciples, "You guys get on the boat, and you go to the other side. They're right on the Sea of Galilee. It's about 6 miles, roughly, across. You just row over there. I'll catch up with you later." So off they went. They started leaning into the oars. And he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitude away, he went up on the mountain there, because there are some steep mountains that come right down to the Sea of Galilee at certain points along the way. So he went up on that point to pray for a time. And he often did that. Now, when evening came, when it finally started getting dark, then he was alone there. Now, the disciples didn't see him come down during the late daylight, so they knew he was up there. They could easily see him go up to where he liked to be by himself. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea. And when we say a sea, the Sea of Galilee is technically the Lake of Gennesaret. It's another name for it. It's a lake. It's roughly 8 miles long and roughly 6 miles wide, the widest spot. But it's a lake. Not only is it a lake, it's in a wind tunnel, one fearsome wind tunnel, because the surface of the Sea of Galilee is 700 feet below sea level. So it's a deep valley. And in the mountains in the north, the wind can come down from the north or can come up from the south, because the Sea of Galilee, is, the top end, is where the Jordan River pours into it. At the south end of the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River pours out of it and goes on down to the Dead Sea, another 65 miles. So you have an ideal setup for wind tunnels. Thus, when the wind comes up on a lake that size, then you tend to get really, really choppy, dangerous waves for small boats. And that's what the disciples were contending with. Some of them, like James and John and Andrew and Peter, they were used to that. They were fishermen. But still, you know, even for fishermen, the wind can get very contrary. And what do you behold? It was verse 24, when the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary, with a bad wind. And in the fourth watch of the night, it would be early in the morning, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. Now, it's not walking on a nice, glassy, smooth sea with little bitty ripples like this. He was walking on a wind-driven, choppy sea with waves 4 or 5 feet high, probably at times at least three to four, but more likely 4 to 5. And I've often wondered, he's walking on that kind of water? It's not the smooth water. This is the choppy water. So, it's a matter of practical thinking. You know, I don't know if you think about things like this, but sometimes I do. If you're going up the back of the wave, do you go up like you're going up steps? And when you get to the top, do you then go like you're going down steps off of it? Or do you get up to the top and then you just sort of get into surfing position and you slide down to the bottom of the trough, which is what they in between the waves is called, and then you climb the next wave and slide to the bottom and climb the next wave and slide to the bottom? Or maybe there's another way you could do it. Maybe because you can just because you can, you don't bother with the waves. You just go smashing through them, and you're walking on the water at the normal, the average level of the water. So you come up to a wave and you just smash it aside with your hands and slog through it with your legs and your knees, and go to the next one and bull your way through that one, or up and down. It wasn't smooth water. And Christ was walking on it. And you got to wonder, how did he walk on the water exactly? They just say he walked on it. It doesn't say exactly how he dealt with those wave things. So that terrified the disciples. And the disciples saw him walking on the sea. Another place says he was almost to walk past him. And they called out. They were terrified. They thought he was a ghost, meaning probably a spirit, because ghosts don't exist. And they cried out in fear. And immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Ah, be of good cheer. And laugh a little, guys. It's just me. Don't be afraid." And Peter, and you can see the whites of their eyes as they're peering over the gunwales, the edge of the boat, staring at him, and just barely get their heads up there that far up because they're terrified. And Peter says, "Lord, if it's you, command me to come down to you on the water." And he said, "Come on in. The water's great." So Peter got down out of the boat and he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid and he beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. And of course, Christ just grabbed him by the hand and lifted him out of the water and said, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? You know how often Peter gets bad press from this? Everybody says, look at that, Peter, he didn't have any faith at all. He sank. What's he doing? That's the wrong question. Look at those 11 disciples hiding in a boat, afraid to get out of the boat. And yet Peter walked on the water at least a little ways. You got to look at the story and think about those things a little bit. But the fact that Jesus just walked on the water and he told Peter, oh, come on in, Peter. You know, like it was just nonchalant and the usual thing to do. And then when they got into the boat, everything went calm. The wind ceased. There's a lot of humor in what Christ did. He could have gotten in another boat. And he could have used, you know, some of his spirit power to row that other boat out there by himself. Choom, 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 and come right up alongside him. He could have done that. But no, he decided to just walk. And he walks out on the choppy Sea of Galilee, kicking his way through the waves. I think he kicked his way through the waves. That's my own theory. But the whole idea of walking on the water is funny. See, just bringing down the house right now. You never thought about it being funny. That's the thing. In order to see Christ's sense of humor, you have to think about it. You have to read these things and to see that there is the greatest intellect there. In fact, there are four reasons why. Let me toss this in at this point. Where have I got this written down? Four reasons why Christ is the greatest humorist in history. Number one, he is good to the core. You know, obeyed God's law, lived God's way of life. Good to the core. The good humorists, when I say humorists, one with a great sense of humor, the good ones are good because most of them aren't good and their jokes aren't good and they're lousy and bad punchlines and or they're ridiculing marriage or they ridicule life. That's not the kind of humor we're interested in at all. That's the wrong kind of humor. Christ was good to the core. His humor was good. Number two, he is and was the most normal and clear-headed person in history. The most normal and clear-headed. There was nobody normaler than him. Therefore, he would see things that others didn't, be that clear-headed part. Number three, he had an overwhelmingly accurate awareness of reality. Because humor sometimes is departing from the reality to make a point. But you have to be acutely aware of the reality in order to depart from it, to come in with a different ending, so to speak. And number four, he had the most dynamic intellect of any human being in history. Most dynamic intellect. That means the quickest wit. And also he had the ultimate wisdom to go with it. So he had to be the greatest humorist. Therefore, walking on water was not done for no good reason. And it wasn't done just to chide Peter for losing faith. Because actually, he was complimenting Peter. You know, oh, you have little faith. Why did you doubt? Look where you were. You were doing it, Peter. You were walking on the water. So I think if we begin to think about these, then we can come to understand a little bit what Christ is doing. Now, let's look at the irony of unexpected meanings or word plays, an unexpected meaning to a word. We'll start in Matthew 4 and verse 19. And Jesus was walking by the Sea of Galilee, and he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and Andrew his brother, casting a net on the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, follow me, boys. I will make you fishers of men. In English, that works perfect. Fishermen, fishers of men. Well, it doesn't work so well in America. We don't do puns. The British would get it. make you fishermen. I'm sure that has that it probably works in any human language, conceptually, if not in words. I'll make you fishers of men. And they immediately left their nets and followed him. You ever wonder why? Why did they leave their nets and follow him that quickly? It's almost like they had planned this. I suspect that was in fact the case. When you read through the New Testament, you find that Christ had a house of his own. In addition to their family home in Nazareth, he had a house in Capernaum. Nazareth is 8 miles from Capernaum. Capernaum is on the northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee. That's where Peter lived, probably Andrew as well. Peter's mother-in-law, who undoubtedly lived with Peter and his wife, fell very sick early in Christ's ministry. That was one of the first healings that he did, was Peter's mother-in-law. So he would have known Christ well. And James and John were partners to Simon and Andrew, or Peter and Andrew, in the fishing business, and they lived in the next village down. So Christ probably knew them too. Furthermore, some historians reckon, based on legends and traditions, that James and John, the sons of Zebedee, that their mother was actually a sister to Mary, thus they would have been first cousins to Christ and his half-brothers and sisters. And that's we can't say that from Scripture. We don't have ironclad historical data to support that. But there are historical traditions that point that direction. But whatever the case, it would show, because Peter and or James and John were in the next paragraph of 20, verse 21 and 2, they had already knew that Christ was going to begin his ministry. They had known him all their lives. So when he came by, they were just waiting for the official start. This wasn't just a fly-by-night, I'm just going to go do this out of the blue. No, this was a decision they had come to, and they knew something of Christ, which is probably one of the prime reasons that James and Peter and John were the three closest disciples to Christ. He often singled them out for the vision of the Transfiguration. And also at the Garden of Gethsemane, he had the 9 stay back, and he took those 3, and they went further into the garden where he talked with them before he went off further than that to pray, and up until the time he was arrested. So, but the bottom line is there's a humorous rejoinder. Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. In chapter 15, let's go back where we were in Matthew chapter 15, look at a couple of other word plays real quickly here before we run out of just too much, not enough time to tell all the funny stuff that Jesus said and did. Just because it's funny doesn't mean it's not true. You know, sometimes, as I said, we think we have to be dead serious in order for the truth to be taught. No. The truth actually is more effectively taught where there's a bit of humor stirred in. A spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down, as they say. Where was I? Chapter 15 of Matthew, verse 14. Okay, we'll start in verse 12. The disciples came to him and said, "Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this saying?" That what he said up in verse 10, you can read, or verse 11. The Pharisees believed that they would be more righteous if they would wash better. If they could get off that outer layer of skin, then they would be more righteous than if they didn't. You know, they were very physically minded in that regard. So it had upset him what he said. It isn't what goes into the mouth that defiles a man, but what comes out of the mouth that defiles a man. And then the disciples came and said, "What you said really upset them." And then it goes on, "Every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted will be uprooted. Leave them alone." In verse 14, "They are the blind leaders of the blind, and if the blind leads the blind, they will both fall into the ditch." And you think, so? All right. "Well, leave them alone. They are the blind leaders of the blind, and if the blind leads the blind, they will both fall into the ditch." It's the repeating of the word blind and using it in an unusual way. They will both, the blind leads the blind. The blind leading the blind? That's funny. It's not funny. You're tough as Youngstown was. So I was reading a book years ago that I somewhere I have it. Frank Buck, I think, was one of his books. Frank Buck is one of the sort of outdoorsman types that went to Africa, Borneo, and various other parts of the world, and they would capture live animals, you know, wild animals live, and they would ship them back to the zoos in America and Europe, and he made quite a living at it. And he had a group of tribesmen, and this was in Kenya, and they were going to, after a gorilla. No, that couldn't be Kenya, possibly Tanzania, but it may have been another country. They were going to trap a gorilla for one of the zoos. As they're walking out, the headman, or the leader of the, sort of the foreman of the fellows he'd hired, was walking along ahead of them, and he was kind of putting on airs in front of the rest of the fellows. And all of a sudden, he fell. He just fell to the ground, and they just died laughing because of them, they don't fall down. Those people are coordinated. They're not like us. American Indians were the same way, phenomenally coordinated. And I stumble over everything. So when somebody falls down, it's a joke, and they laugh. Well, they didn't know he fell down because an 18-foot python had latched onto him. And he was fighting for his life, rolling in the grass with this python. And when Frank Buck realized what was happening, they went over to see, and he shouted at the guys to stop laughing and get a hold of the snake and stretch it out. And then they stretch it out, they can't constrict, so then he saved the guy's life. That was their style of humor. It was just out of the ordinary. He fell down. He was super coordinated. You never fall down. So the unexpected is the beauty of it, and that's the humor that Christ was using here, that they blind leaders of the blind. All right, let's try another one in Matthew chapter 16, just over the page, verses 16 to 18. Let's see if we get this one. He says, Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ." The Christ had asked the disciples, and said, "Who do men think that I am? Say that I am?" And he says, "Some say you're Jeremiah, or you're John the Baptist, or one of the prophets." Why would they say that? Well, they knew, the people knew that there would be a resurrection. What they didn't understand is the timing and the extent of the resurrection. That was to be filled in by the New Testament. And the timing all comes clear in the writings of Paul and John. But then Christ said, "So who do you think that I am?" And Peter says, "You are the Christ," that is the Messiah, "the Son of the living God." They knew who he was. And Jesus said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah." Bar means son of Jonah. Actually, technically, Jonah is where we get the word John. So it would be Simon Johnson in modern English would be his name. "But blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you, you are Peter." In Greek, you are Petros. And his nickname was Peter. "You are Petros," which means a stone. Smaller than a bottle of water. Just as a stone you pick up in your hand and you could chuck out into the water and watch it splash. "You are a stone, and on this rock..." The word for rock in Greek is Petra, Petra, P-E-T-R-A in English letters, which means a massive expanse of rock. Maybe a giant boulder there at the spring. It was one of the headwaters of the Jordan River where they were, and there were springs that came out of the mountain there. Or maybe the cliff face itself, and Christ put his hand on it, and on this rock, this Petra, "I will build my church, and the gates of the grave," Hades, "will not prevail against it." It's a wordplay. Petros, meaning rock, little rock, and Petra, meaning massive expanse of rock. What Christ was saying was, the true church of God is not built on Peter. It's built on Christ, is what it is. Not all the world understands that, but it's a wordplay, the unexpected wordplay. You're just stony. You're just a little rock. But on this massive rock, I will build my church. And then Matthew 23. I want to try this blind guides thing one more time to see if it works. Christ used it another time here. It's in Matthew 23. Matthew 23 is, you call this chapter the big red button. Sometime we'll go through it in a Bible study. But this was about a week before the crucifixion. You know, a week before he would die, therefore, maybe 10 days. And it was time to go push the big red button and precipitate the anger of the religious leaders of the country to bring about his sacrifice. And so that's what Christ did. And it is one hot piece. He takes the Pharisees to task every which way, and the Sadducees, you know, were tossed in with that, but especially the Pharisees. So we're dropped down to verse 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, who hypocrites! You pay the tithe of mint. How do you measure mint? You measure it in leaves. Yeah. One for me, and one for God, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 for me, 1 for God, laying little mint leaves down. Oh, they were meticulous. They're going to obey it to the letter of the law. And anise, how do you measure anise? You get licorice flavor out of anise. It's a little herb plant. You use the little buds. So you have a tiny anise bud about that big around, and 1 for God, and 9 for me, and 1 for God, and 9 for me. And they're not being generous. And cumin. Cumin is another spice. Very delicious spice, by the way. But it gets real dusty. It crumbles up. So here's a little bit of dust for God, and 9 bits of dust for me, a little bit of dust for God. You know, look how meticulous they were. They were trying to be righteous to the letter. Never go beyond just the letter. He says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. You pay the tithe of the mint and the anise and the cumin, but you've neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These ought you to have done without leaving the others undone. And then he calls them in verse 24, blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. So we see they're called blind guides again. That seem funnier this time? Blind guides? How smart is an ox? I mean, as compared to a well-schooled human being. Not very smart. They're morons. And that's what this is. It's an oxymoron. In other words, two words that don't go together are used together. An oxymoron. But that's not all. That's not all. This line is great. You strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. But we have to get to the language to find out camel and gnat. The word for gnat is in English letters, from how it had been said in Aramaic, which was the common everyday language, it's very similar to Hebrew, is galma. G-A-L-M-A. That's gnat. Galma. You strain out a galma and swaddle a gamla. Camel is G-A-M-L-A. So the gnat is G-A-L-M-A, and the camel is G-A-M-L-A. Which you can see where the word camel comes from that. The g and the k are audio phonetically similar. And so we can get camel from gamma. But the gnat was galma, the camel was gamla. That's the beauty, an unexpected meaning, and of course it wasn't lost probably on there. If it was lost on the Pharisees, because they weren't very funny, it wasn't lost on the crowd. They appreciated that. There's a whole long list of other things that I don't really have time to go through all of Christ's humor. In fact, as I said, there's another section I would like to go into the Old Testament and show you the humor of God, and so that we can appreciate what God does in this particular regard, and help to be, you know, a little more joyful ourselves to express that fruit of God's Spirit. There's another example of the irony of repetition, unexpected repetition. You can read this one later. I'll just describe it. It's in Luke 15, the whole chapter. There are three parables told in succession by Jesus. And in each case, they have the sadness of losing something and then the joy of finding it. So you have the lost sheep parable, you have the lost coin parable, and you have the lost son, or the prodigal son parable. You know, that which is lost is found, and there's rejoicing because it was found. So that it's the fact you line those up like that. That shows a sense of humor. Not your belly laugh sense of humor, but your very intelligent, clever, pleasant sense of humor. And he did the same thing with Peter, and you know this story. It's in John chapter 21. Again, I'll let you read it. It's the last part of the chapter. It's after Christ's resurrection, and they're at the Sea of Galilee, and Christ calls to him to see if they've caught any fish. And they say, you know, none. He says, well, throw your net on the other side of the boat, and then they can't get it into the boat, so they have to row the two boats back to the shore, dragging the net. Peter jumps in and swims ahead, and Christ already has fish cooking on the campfire and bread cooking. And after they'd all eaten, he's sitting there and he's talking to Peter. Peter, do you love me? And Peter said, yes, Master, I love you. He said, feed my sheep. And a few seconds later, he said, Peter, do you love me? And he said, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he says, feed my lambs. And it isn't but a few seconds later, he says, Peter, do you love me? He says, yes, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Feed my sheep. And by the way, you're going to die as a martyr. That's the story of it. But again, the fact that Christ repeated the thing three times, and it was getting a little on Peter's nerves. I think you can pick that up in the account. But that was a part of his sense of humor. He told stories. He created parables. He quoted poetry, mostly Isaiah, but occasionally the lyrics of popular songs. He had a bubble-popping satire, sometime to sit down and read the first seven verses of chapter 23 of Matthew, and you find out how bubble-popping his satire was. He took those boys down, not one notch, but a bunch of notches. And they didn't like it. It was not the way to make friends and influence people. It was a way, well, it was to influence them. There was something that was going to be done. Then there's the irony of humorous insight. That's part of it, by the way, the humorous insight. There was a time when the 70 were sent out on a mission to preach the gospel and heal the sick and cast out demons. And this is not the 12. They had been sent on a separate mission. And they came back, and they were so excited. Even the demons have to do what we tell them. You know, when they cast them out of people who were demon-possessed. And Christ stands there listening to their excitement, and he doesn't say anything, and they pause, and he says, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. See, Christ struck down Satan in his original rebellion. So when they were excited about casting out demons, it was a humorous pause, not funny humorous, but there was a sense of humor in the pause and then that ironic statement that he dropped on them. I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Hopefully you will appreciate more the structure of how Christ taught and frankly how he teaches us. He lets us, you know, step in our own messes and have to fix them up and resolve them in our lives today. But he certainly works with us and guides us. John chapter 16, verse 33, this is our last one, and this is a profound example of his sense of humor. Again, it's not a belly laugh sense of humor in this particular regard, because he's about to go out to be crucified. He comes right at the end of the teaching session of the very first New Testament Passover. Bear in mind, that Passover was the last Old Testament Passover and the first New Testament Passover. The Old Testament Passover, they ate the lamb and the whole thing that was laid out for the Old Testament. And then when that was done, Christ, they set that aside, and the supper being ended, he washed the feet of the disciples, just like we do today. That's John 13. And then he offered them a piece of the unleavened bread as a symbol of his broken body, and a sip of the wine, a symbol of his shed blood for the sins of mankind. And then when that was done, there was an extended teaching session, which concludes at the end of chapter 16. We observe the Passover exactly in the same format that Christ established in the gospel accounts. We end with a teaching session. So here we are, chapter 16. And Jesus asked them a question in verse 31. He says, do you now believe? He said, indeed, the hour is coming. Yes, it has now come that you will be scattered, each to his own, and you will leave me alone. And yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. Now these things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. All that Christ teaches us, that in him we can have peace. In the world you will have tribulation. And they did. And 11 of the 12 were martyred. In the world you will have tribulation. but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Again, it's sort of the ironic comment at the end. An irony of humorous insight. Good cheer. Be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. We're all going to die. You know, we're going into a spiritual war, boys, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. We will win in the end. And that's the greatest joy of it all.